young girl, they do get weary, wearing.
Back in the 1960s, Stax Records served as the incubator of the Memphis, Tennessee soul music genre. This is where musicians like Otis Redding, Isaac Hayes, Albert King, Rufus and Carla Thomas, and Booker T and the MGs came to cut their records. Over a 16-year period, Stax Records placed 167 hit songs in the top 100 on the pop charts and 243 hits in the top 100 rhythm and blues charts. Come along and join Tim Sampson, Communications Director for the Soulsville Foundation, where he talks about the Stax Museum of American Soul Music, the genesis of the term Soulsville, the astounding Stax Music Academy, and Soulsville Charter School.
Right now we are in the Stax Museum at the original site of Stax Records. We're in the Hall of Records, where there's about 800 singles on the walls and 300 albums. This is what I call the art gallery, because this is when they really put a lot of work into the album design. So you're seeing albums by artists like Otis Redding, Booker T and the MGs, Isaac Hayes, Johnny Taylor, the Staple Singers, the Marquis, Little Milton, Rufus and Carla Thomas. Those are a lot of the people who recorded at Stax Records and made it the international influential label that it became.
Stax Records has been a part of our collective Americana history for a long time.
Yeah.
But augering down a dimension that I did not understand until I got here to Memphis has to do with Soulsville. That's an incredible story. Stax Records is intimately intertwined and connected with our collective history, you know, as Americana idiom.
We are in Soulsville, the neighborhood known as Soulsville,
yes,
USA.
Which is literal and true. Tell us that story.
It is. Well, it got its name because Detroit, Motown, their nickname was Hitsville. And when Al Bell came to Memphis in 65, he renamed this Soulsville. Then it kind of grew, and the whole neighborhood became known as Soulsville, USA. And you have all these artists who were born here or grew up here or recorded here. Aretha Franklin was born about 5 minutes from where we're standing. Maurice White, who founded Earth, Wind, and Fire, grew up two blocks away. Memphis Slim, Memphis Mini. If you go two or three blocks in this direction, you're going to find Royal Studio, which was High Records, which was where Al Green recorded all of his music. And this is a relatively small area.
You're talking about a few blocks in one direction and
another.
Yeah, you
know, you walk past Booker T. Jones' former home, and you go around the corner, and you're at Aretha Franklin's former home's front yard. So there was just this neighborhood was filled with music and musicians, and there was a couple of nearby high schools that had, you know, back in the day, these great band directors, and tons of churches where the kids grew up singing in the choir and playing in the band. And it's just sort of just this melting pot, and it's still kind of that way today.
But that whole dynamic, that whole passion for music within these neighborhoods predates Stax.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, in Memphis, you had music forever, you know, Beale Street, starting back in the 20s and 30s, and then you had all the big bands and the jazz and the blues and gospel music, and it's just one of those cities where the timing was right, the timing was weird. It's, you know, it's on the Mississippi River. A lot of people migrated here from the South, you know, when they were freed as slaves. And Memphis has always been sort of this really cool, rebellious kind of town where people just do what they want, not caring what anybody thinks about it, like Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis and Isaac Hayes and people like that. So yeah, it's
even looping back to the genesis and the creation of Stax Records is an anomaly in Memphis
at
that point in time.
Oh, Jim Stewart started Stax Records as Satellite Records to record country music. He liked what Sam Phillips was doing over at Sun Records with Johnny Cash and all these people, and he thought, well, you know, I can be a record producer too, so I'll just take my tape recorder to my aunt's garage and bring some bands over there and record them, and that's the way it started. And then he moved into where we are now in 1959 or 60 and to record country music. And then By chance, he met Rufus and Carla Thomas. They came over here and did a song. It became a hit. He fell in love with the music. He fell in love with the income because it was a lot more than what his Bad Country records were doing. And he was not a racist, just because back then so many people were. And he wasn't. And his sister, who invested in the company early on, wasn't. They didn't care.
And just as a reference, these are white people.
Yeah, the white brother and sister who did not care about color. They cared about music. They loved music. They welcomed anybody through this door who wanted to audition or could play, regardless. And this was one of the only integrated companies in the South. And it was not easy. It was easy inside Stax. It was not easy externally because I've heard stories of the Stax artists tell me about a black and a white artist walking outside the building and standing on the sidewalk and having a policeman pull up and draw a gun on them and tell them to get back inside, that it wasn't happening.
Wow.
And when they first started, they couldn't eat at the same restaurants here. They couldn't drink out of the same water fountains, couldn't stay in any of the same hotels. So touring was difficult. And even if you look back, Booker T and the MGs, which was two black guys, two white guys, didn't have their photograph on an album cover until maybe their fourth album, because they were afraid nobody would buy it.
Very fascinating.
Yeah.
What were the first real big-time successes of Stax Records that put them on the map?
The first big-time success was a group of high school kids called the Marquees, and that was Steve Cropper and Duck Dunn, and they let Estelle Axton's son, Packy, join the group because they knew she had this recording studio over here, and some other kids, and they did a song called Last Night, and it was a dance song, and everybody fell in love with it, and it sold a million copies. They started traveling, going to American Bandstand. They had two versions of it. They had the recorded version, which was an integrated band, and the touring version, which was an all-white band, because that's the way they had to do it back then, because they couldn't.
That's painful.
Very painful, and believe me, there's still some feelings that are pretty raw today. But that song sold a million copies. Shortly thereafter, Gee Whiz by Carla Thomas sold a million copies. In 62, Green Onions by Booker T and the MGs. So what happened was when Last Night came out and became such a big hit, Jim Stewart and Estelle Axton found out there was already another Satellite Records. So that's how we got the name changed. They had to change the name, so they took the ST from Stewart and the AX from Axton and formed Stax Records, and
I thought they were stacking up records.
Yeah, no, they used that pun a lot in logos and everything else.
Very fascinating.
But here they were. You know, Jim Stewart, he was a banker. He kept his day job until 1965. It just came over here at night. It was when one of the Otis Redding songs came out, and he thought, okay, I can quit my job at the bank now and do this full time. Mm-hmm. And they had a record store in what had been the candy counter of the, because this is an old movie theater. Yeah. You know, we still have the slanted floor. And so what happened was Estelle decided to open a record store up front to make some extra money, but it also attracted neighborhood kids. And she used it as a marketing tool. She would put certain records on and watch the reaction of the kids, and if it real positive and they were dancing and they loved it, she would take it back to the studio and say, okay, this is what they love up front, so this is what y'all need to do, something like this.
That's really fascinating.
Yeah. She was great. She was the Lady A. She was the mother hen of the whole company.
Some more of the icons of Stax Records throughout the year 60s.
Oh, let's see. Otis Redding, Isaac Hayes, Eddie Floyd, Johnny Taylor, Rufus and Carla Thomas, the Staple Singers, Albert King, Sam and Dave, Hold On, I'm Coming, Soul Man, the Barquets with Soul Finger, and there was a lot.
And then something happened. There was a game shift after 69, 70. Things started going south for some reason.
Well, Stax basically has two periods. There's the period from beginning up to late 1967, early 1968, because in 1967, in a fine line deal with Atlantic Records, Stax lost every bit of its catalog. They had no product to sell.
What happened?
It was something in a contract that Jim Stewart didn't somehow, you know, he was a music maker, not a business executive. So Atlantic Records took all of the masters, all of the product. Stax was left with nothing. On December 10th of that year, Otis Redding and the Barquets were killed in a plane crash. He was 26 years old and their biggest star. Him and all these teenagers in his backing band, all but one got killed And that was a huge blow. And then when Martin Luther King was assassinated in April of 1968, that was another big blow to the world. And Stax Records just happened to be part of it.
It was part of it, ground zero. And
it was like Memphis's 9/11. You know, it was crazy. So
how far away is the Lorraine Motel?
It's about a 5-minute drive from here. And ironically, that's where the Stax artists used to go hang out and eat lunch and swim and write songs, because everybody was welcome there. And that's where Martin Luther King ended up being assassinated. In fact, not a lot of people know this, but one of the artists on Stax was Mabel John, and she was in town recording, and she gave up her hotel room so that Martin Luther King could have the one that he wanted to stay in the front.
Wow.
I think she had to live with that for, you know, her whole life. So Al Bell came in. He said, all right, we're not going to go down. We're not going to go out of business. We're going to record 28 albums in 1 month. We're going to use every recording studio, every artist we can bring in here. It's going to be 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So they did it. They recorded 28 albums, and they had a giant sales conference and press conference and everything. And then it generated enough product and publicity to get Stax back on its feet. And then he started bringing in the Staple Singers and the Dramatics and some of those other big groups that are the whole second era of Stax, which includes Isaac Hayes as a performer, because he was just a songwriter until 1969. In 69, he broke out and went solo, and then really went huge in like the early 70s, just, you know, won the Academy Award for Shaft, and Hot Buttered Soul was one of the biggest selling albums of all time. So it did have a nice prosperous second era, and then that's when basically the business community and a lot of other people thought that Al Bell had too much power and too much money, because Al Bell was black, and they basically set out to destroy him, and they did. They defaulted on a $1,900 loan was the final straw, and Al Bell pulled that money out of his pocket and said, I'll just pay this to you right now. I have it in my pocket. And they said, no, we're shutting this place down. We're padlocking it. You're out of business.
Sounds like the bank industry today.
Yeah. Only it's not so much out of racism like it was back then.
You know, they'll take anybody down.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, wow, how fascinating. So yeah. That was the end of Stax Records.
That was the end of Stax. Well, you know, they branched out. They lingered on for a little while longer. And Stax Records was kind of forgotten in Memphis, Tennessee, until we started this project here. All of a sudden, this new generation of people who didn't know about Stax and the old generation who did know about Stax were suddenly blown away by the story and the music and just the magnitude that it had on Memphis.
Do you think because it was local and these were locals that people took it for granted and it took looking at it from a distant lens to appreciate it?
I think that people just forgot about Stax because it was a real painful ending. I think they still listened to and loved the music, but they didn't know the story. There were all sorts of rumors about what happened at Stax and all sorts of misperceptions and that kind of thing. But when we started building the museum, people from all over the world started just going crazy, thinking, finally, Memphis, Tennessee is going to put a shrine there where that record company used to be. That was the most important record company in the world. So we started gaining the interest of not only people all over the world, but people in Memphis. Suddenly, especially in this neighborhood, we became sort of proud to live here again. And now that they've seen what we've done and what we've done with the Stax Music Academy students who have traveled all over the world, what we've done with the Soulsville Charter School, where every single senior for 6 years has graduated and gone to college in a zip code that's one of the poorest in the country.
I was going to say, when you guys made the commitment to build the reincarnation of Stax, it was a sketchy neighborhood.
Sketchy is a nice word for it, because Stax had been demolished. Now, I was here the day that the original founders came over here to look around, and it was a freezing cold day in January, and we were on this empty lot, basically thinking we were going to get shot any minute. It was drug houses and broken glass, and where the Stax Music Academy stands right now, there was an abandoned apartment building, 65 units with no windows, full of garbage. There was garbage everywhere. There was a burned-up school bus on the lot. There was a refrigerator with no door. It was the worst scene of urban blight that anybody could imagine. And we all stood there thinking, okay, is this going to happen? Is anybody going to come to this museum? Thank goodness their vision was, we're going to build a museum, but we're not going to build a museum unless we build a school for these kids. Because these kids in this neighborhood have absolutely nothing but to get in trouble or sit in front of a TV all day if they have one. and drop out of school and get pregnant when they're teenagers and get hooked on drugs.
Tell us about the Academy of the school. That's a phenomenal success
story. The Academy is a great success story. The Academy started out in 2000 in a lunchroom of a nearby elementary school while everything here was under construction. It was basically little kids back then. Their first teacher was Rufus Thomas, which was really great. And it was more of we got to have a safe place for these kids to be. So all that kind of changed. We were serving 250 students every summer, young kids. And when the economy tanked in 2008, we had to rethink everything because we couldn't afford that. So we thought, we're going to serve fewer students, older students, and we're going to be the best music school in the world. And we're going to teach music theory and songwriting and marketing and engineering and real instruments, real voices, all that. So we did that. We partnered with the Berklee College of Music in Boston. And since then, the kids have performed in Italy, Australia, Berlin, New York's Lincoln Center, Kennedy Center. They've opened for B.B. King. They played for Oprah Winfrey. We played for 3 days on the National Mall for the grand opening of the Smithsonian's new African American Museum, and the crowds were crazed. The kids are so talented. In 2005, we had this big empty building with kids coming after school and in the summertime. So we thought, well, we've got this beautiful big building. We can serve more kids. Let's do academics. We've got music down. So we started an academic college prep school, 66 graders. That now has school has 650 students in it, 100% college acceptance rate among the 6 graduating classes we've had so far. A little over 300 seniors with over $50 million in scholarships and grants.
So every graduating kid goes on to college?
Yes, and we have counselors who keep up with them in college until they graduate because 90% of them are first-generation college attendees.
You know how rare that is?
It's so rare that I have to pinch myself every day that I see that school because these kids, they're getting a free private school education. And they understand why we hold them to such high standards and why the discipline is so strict. And they appreciate the fact that they are getting something that not a lot of kids are going to get.
And they wear uniforms, blazers.
Yeah, they wear blazers and neckties, and girls have skirts and pants. And on certain days, if they've earned enough Grammy points for good behavior and good grades and all that sort of thing, they get to wear a college T-shirt, get to eat at lunch outside. There's a lot of carrot dangling.
Is this model being replicated?
I don't know that we're absolutely being replicated, but I do know that the Otis Redding Foundation is planning to open a charter school, and they are in serious talks with us.
And where is Otis Redding School?
That's in Macon, Georgia, where he was from. We have met with the principals at Motown. They're interested in doing some youth programming, and they came down to see us. I just hope everybody comes here and sees this place. It's the only soul music museum in the world. And
you know, we never finished the story about the neighborhood. So here it was, sketchy neighborhood. As time went forward, what happened?
Well, we invested a lot of money into 4 buildings on the original site of Stax Records on several acres. A local college development corporation built a development across the street that is now owned by a movie director who's getting ready to do some things with it. We never wanted to change the flavor of the neighborhood. We just wanted to revitalize it. So you'll see, I can drive around to see where I know there used to be abandoned homes and empty lots and burned up houses. I see new houses that have been built that look like they blend right in with the neighborhood. It's hard to even tell they're new. See people with cleaned up, painted front porches. We haven't gotten the business investment that we thought we would have by now, just for the neighborhood. But there are things like Memphis Slim, the bluesman who used to live next door, his house was caving in for years and years and years. And another organization got possession of it, and they took it apart, and they rebuilt it with the original materials as the Memphis Slim Collaboratory. It's a recording studio. It's a place for art exhibits and films and young musicians, old musicians. You can join for very little money and be able to record music there and rehearse there and stream live from there. And we partner with them on a lot of projects, and we do a lot of oral histories over there. It's just next door. So you'll see some really nice murals that have been done and things like that. But overall, it's still a very poor neighborhood. For further information, go to staxmuseum.com. Information about the Stax Music Academy, go to staxmusicacademy.org. And for information about our college prep school, go to soulsvillecharterschool.org. And my name is Tim Sampson, and we are here at the site of Stax Records.
Tim, an absolute pleasure to spend the day with you.
Thank you so much. You too.
Known fondly as the birthplace of rock and roll, Sun Studio opened its doors as Memphis Recording Service back in 1950. It was Jackie Brenson and his Delta Cats' Rocket 88, Sun Records recording in 1951, that goes down in history as the first rock and roll single. A litany of legends came to Sun Studio to record and make music history. Cats like Howlin' Wolf, James Cotton, B.B. King, and Johnny Cash. This is the place where Elvis recorded his first single, That's All Right, back in 1954.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you.
And Sun is still recording music in the same location today, in the same studio, using lots of the original tube technology equipment. Come along and join me at Sun Studio with Memphis musician Tiffany Harmon.
Well, Mama, she done told me, Papa done told me too.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Memphis, Tennessee. Right now we're with Tiffany Harmon, and we're at Sun Records.
Glad you guys joined us today.
It's an absolute delight, the mothership.
Oh, yes. Hallowed ground. Mm-hmm. Birthplace of rock and roll. Sam Phillips was the founder. He was a 27-year-old radio engineer from Florence, Alabama. Moved to Memphis here when he was about 27, started working for a radio station called WREC. Played mostly pop music, and Sam was not a huge fan of pop music, so he had more passionate about the blues. So that was the real sound that Sam Phillips wanted to capture with his business. So he was able to save up enough money working for the radio station, and he signed a lease on a little storefront here at 706 Union Avenue and opened the Memphis Recording Service. Started out recording blues artists and radio advertisements. He would record anything, anywhere, anytime. And so that meant, you know, recording anything from radio advertisements to anybody who would come in, anybody who wanted to come in and record here. So blues artists started coming in, B.B. King, Joe Hill Lewis, Howlin' Wolf, and all those guys, Roscoe Gordon.
This is in the days of segregation. Tell us about that connection.
It was a very heavily segregated town in Memphis. The place that we're at right now used to be an auto industrial area where mostly white business owners in the area, and there was a lot of racism that Sam had to fight against with his clients coming in and getting harassed on the street. What Sam Phillips and Dewey Phillips did for racial integration was an incredible thing, and they brought together the races with a format, you know, radio, and that was a huge thing. Radio and soon-to-be Sun label that was releasing these race artists and, you know, all that good stuff.
Talk for a moment about Johnny Cash.
He came in. He started out as a gospel singer, but he wanted to come in and start recording here. Sam actually was not very impressed with his sound in the beginning. I've heard the little story about Johnny Cash coming in and singing some gospel tunes, and Sam actually told him at one point, he said, "Son, you need to go out, sing a little bit, write a new song, and come back and see me when you're done." So that was pretty cool.
Another one, seminal moment, Elvis Presley knocking on the door.
That's right. Elvis came in to record a record. Some people said it was for his mom's birthday. Chances are unlikely because his mom's birthday was a few months prior to the recording date. Chances are more likely he just wanted to get discovered. So he comes in to record a little two-sided record, and Sam actually was not impressed with the recording at first when he heard it.
Later on, he hit the mark. Tell us about that story.
Yes. Fateful night, July 5th, 1954. It was a night when Sam introduced Elvis to Scotty Moore and Bill Black. And they started out playing some slow gospel tunes. Nothing was catching Sam's interest. But finally, when Sam took a little break in the control room where we're at right now, Elvis started getting really nervous, and he started thinking of what song can I play that might win Sam over, and he started thinking about these old blues tunes, and he came up with That's All Right, this old Arthur Big Boy Crudup song, and he started playing it, but he added a country twist to it so Bill and Scotty could keep up, and that is when Sam's attention was caught.
Before we go, overview where we are. We're in living history.
We are in the control room, Sam Phillips' control room at 706 Union Avenue. We are still a fully functioning and operating recording studio. We've gone back to the old ways of doing things, anything, anywhere, anytime.
Some of the artists that people would recognize today that still come here and record.
Margot Price recorded something recently here. Maroon 5 recorded some stuff here. Bruno Mars came to visit. You know, we do record anybody who wants to make an appointment here. Bon Jovi did come by and visit us the other day, a couple weeks ago before his show. We have a lot of touring musicians. And the cool thing is, if you are a touring musician, if you bring us some merchandise, we give you free admission tickets. So.
You two, they're looking for their drum set?
That's right. That's right. Well, they said they can pick it up. That was in 1987. We still have their drum set from the session. I think it's a Ludwig. It's a beautiful set, but we've got it in the studio still.
Thank you, Tiffany Harmon, so much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Hope you all see us again soon, okay?
Yeah. Now, are you going to sing us a song?
Oh, goodness. What would you like to hear? Any requests? Well, here, I can play you. I'll play you an Ernie Chafin song on the guitar. I don't really know the chords for it, but let me see. Okay. This is an Ernie Chafin song. It was recorded here in the 50s. It's called My Heart Tells Me. I don't care what you have done. My heart tells me you're the one that I've been waiting for through all the years. They all tell me it's no good. You wouldn't love me like you should, but my heart tells me I don't need to fear. Though another's lips have kissed you and you wore his ring, you once thought the world of him. His loss has been my gain. So I will always hold you close, hope and pray you love me the most. 'Cause my heart tells me I will never change.
Wow.
So
that's
good.
Awesome.
Thank
yeah.
you.
So nice,
thank
man.
You
that
so
was,
much.
Yeah,
thank
really.
You.
You sound like Marilyn Monroe. Your
oh,
voice
wow.
Yeah.
Thank
yeah.
you.
Also,
I love
yeah.
You also have a
yeah.
40s voice.
Thank you.
Really
you. That's my specialty thank when you. I'm performing. I play a lot.
Boo Mitchell carries on the legacy of his legendary father, Willie Mitchell, as a premier producer of chart-topping hits. Boo's father is remembered and revered as a true pioneer of the Memphis soul sound. It was a partnership between Al Green and Willie Mitchell that created a home run hit back in 1971, followed by a number one hit every year for 4 years straight. One of Boo Mitchell's proudest achievements was taking home the Record of the Year Grammy in 2016. The first time in the history of the Grammy Awards that a Memphis-made record garnered the award. One of many amazing and distinctive nuances of the Royal Studios production facility today, instituted by Boo's father back in the 1960s and 70s, is its unabated, tenacious reliance on old-fashioned tube technology recording equipment, such as the 8-channel Ampex 351 reel-to-reel tape recorder, old-style mics, and more. Come along and join Boo Mitchell in the control room at Royal Studios, located in the heart of Memphis, Tennessee. Never be
untrue. Oh, baby. Hi, I'm Lawrence Boo Mitchell. I'm the owner, manager of Royal Studios. I've been in the music business all my life.
You grew up in it, didn't you?
I grew up in it, yes. Yeah.
Tell us about your dad.
Willie Mitchell, my dad was Al Green's producer and all those high records, so I had a magical childhood growing up being in the studio with you know, people like Al Green and Keith Richards and just all kinds of people.
But since you were born into it, that's what you knew. That was like your baseline, right? So it wasn't, oh, my God. It was, oh, Al's here. Right?
Yeah, exactly. We would do stuff like, you know, the Doobie Brothers would come to town and my dad would take them to, like, Piccadilly Cafeteria for lunch. You know, the Temptations would be in town. You know, they'd come to the house for dinner, sing Happy Birthday to the kids. And
but that was just intertwined into your daily life. So it wasn't as special as somebody looking from the outside, right?
Right. And being older, I have more of an appreciation for it now. You know, I look back, I was like, Jesus Christ, man, I'm hanging out with the Jacksons and, you know. So all this magical stuff that I didn't really, that seemed normal, you know. But I've grown to appreciate my childhood and, you know, the history of the studio and the legacy. That's why it's so important for me to preserve my father's legacy and the legacy of Royal Studios and to keep it going and to keep pushing the envelope.
Well, let's go back to Kiddom again. He was your dad, and he'd kick your butt sometimes. So he wasn't a god in that sense, right?
Right. So a couple of times, yeah. Pop, it's like nobody wanted to disappoint him in the studio. That's why everybody, he got the nickname Pops, because he was like a father figure to everybody. And if you disappointed him, you felt worse than any butt whooping. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That was a punishment.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, he was just one of those figures that you wanted to please because he was such a loving and kind person. He was everything to me. I wanted to be just like him. I used to go to church and pray that I want to be an engineer, a producer, and a song. You know, I didn't know what it all meant at the time.
But you knew that's,
that's how I wanted to be what my dad was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And here you are.
Here we are.
So in a way, he's still here, isn't he?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You feel him, yes.
Yeah, so, you know, you have What Would Jesus Do, and then I also have What Would Papa Do. So anytime I'm in the studio and, you know, I get stuck or something and get to a play, I just have to think, okay, what would Papa do?
So he's your default, yeah.
He's my default.
Yeah, looking over your shoulder.
Absolutely.
Tell us about when you first got it.
It kind of hit me maybe my junior year in high school that, okay, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And I started out as a rapper in producing beats and stuff like that. And I did that for about 4 or 5 years. And then I started getting into producing other people and getting into the art of actually recording, engineering and stuff. So even when I got older and started being the engineer for my dad, that was like life-changing for me. Just picking his brain, you know, we would drive home and I'd, you know, well, how did you mic this? What did you do? You know, when I got old enough and wise enough to ask the questions, because sometimes when you're a kid, you know, and your dad, you're like, okay, Pop did all this stuff, but we're trying to do this new stuff over here, and you don't realize what a treasure you have. So by the time I was about 30, it just kind of hit me, hey, this is an encyclopedia of musical knowledge that I can't get anywhere on the planet. And so I started picking his brain and asking him about, you know, chord progressions and how he mic'd things and just all kinds of stuff.
You are pumping in a lot of different music all at once and balancing. That's an art in itself. Huge, isn't it?
Yeah, I grew up listening to everything. So, you know, when I would come home from school, I would listen to AC/DC and Rick James and SOS Band and, you know, Toto. So I was kind of
wide open.
Yeah, I was all over the place. So I just realized that I like good music, no matter what genre it is, you know. I've heard something in just about every genre that I like. So it makes me versatile as a producer and as an engineer because I really like the music that I make.
But you're wide open. To this day, a wide breadth of music comes in these doors, right?
absolutely. We've done everybody from the Wu-Tang Clan to Robert Plant, just all different kind of genres of music.
And tell us about the journeys, one of the recent ones, how the guys sought you out and hunted you down. That's a great story.
Well, I did Mark Ronson's Uptown Special album that has the hit Uptown Funk. That was a session that kind of changed my life.
You didn't know it going in, did you?
No, I knew something. I had a feeling about, once I figured out how to spell Mark's name and could Google him properly, because he came here looking for singers, and the person that set up the meeting for him to come here and hear these people sing, I never really caught the name. You know, I was like, what did she say his name was? And so once I figured, I was like, oh, this dude is awesome. You know, he's made some of my favorite records. And he had never been to Royal. And when he walked in, you know, he was just really inspired by the room. He said he has the best description of Royal Studios. He said the room makes you feel like playing music.
Let's do a word picture of the studios, because it's not what somebody would think. I mean, this is like a archive of history here. It's unchanged. This is stuff that your dad did, right?
Yeah, it's unchanged since 69. My dad, he put up fiberglass insulation and burlap. He wanted his records to sound different, basically. And he wanted to, you know, you had the Motown sound and these other sounds, and he wanted to go the complete opposite direction. So he was quieting his room, and it's still the same, you know, the orange burlap, the green burlap,
cedar shingles.
Mm-hmm. And it affects the room. You know, Al Green's Tired of Being Alone was the first record that he recorded with the perfected Willa Mitchell configuration. And you can listen to records that came out on Higher Records before then, and you can hear the evolution of the sound, and till it gets to that signature sound, you know, that you know.
And let's talk about even here at the control room we're sitting in, that you did a recording in here with a $79 mic. That's a great story.
Yeah, so when Bruno Mars was here, they were working on Uptown Funk, and they were writing it, and we were up all night. Came time for him to do the vocal, so we put him in the vocal booth, obviously, with, you know, $20,000 mic. And me and some of his bandmates were in the control room, and we were kind of dancing and, you know, having a good time while he was singing. And he goes, hey, I want to do the vocal in there with you guys. And I was like, oh, crap, that's an engineer's nightmare to do a vocal in the control room. So all I could think of was, like, SM57.
Why? I mean, that's like a $100 mic.
Because it won't feed back. Okay. You know, in the control room, there's no headphones in here. The music's pumping out of the speakers. So you have to have a mic that is not really sensitive and it's not going to feed back. And the 57 is perfect for that. And so he did the vocal, and I just knew they were going to replace it. And his engineer, Charles, called me about a week after. He goes, you know the vocal we did on the SM57? I was like, yeah. He said, you know, we're keeping that. Really? It's like, okay. And it sounds great, and it won me a Grammy, so thank you, sure.
What a paradox, isn't it? And your board here, I mean, this is a...
Okay, so this board came from Compass Point Studios in the Bahamas.
It looks like 70s.
It's a 77 vintage. It's an MCI 536. And some of my favorite rock records were made on this board, like Back in Black. And my dad, once he got it here, he, like, had all a bunch of, you know, had it recapped and op amps changed, because he doesn't like factory anything. But this board, it has a unique sound. That's another thing. When Mark Ronson came in, he looked at the desk and he goes, oh, I've got the same board. I remember I bought it because I read your dad had it. it sounds amazing, man.
But you've got tube technology here, 8-track Ampex that's probably the same vintage, and you still use a lot of that stuff.
Absolutely. I'm really into vintage, and I'm into, even my approach to music is kind of bridging the gap with old gear and new stuff, and old stuff. You know, my whole existence is based off of legacy and history, and you know, that's my strength to go to the future. So yeah, I have lots of the MPEX 8-track. It's not a factory thing. My dad had somebody make it. When 8-tracks came out, the 8-track tape recorders were all solid state. And Papa had one for about a week and decided that it sounded like crap. So some guy in Texas made him an all-2 8-track tape recorder. So it's 8 MPEX 351 head stacks and, you know, retrofitted on an 8-track tape machine.
I guess it goes the same reason that vinyl's coming back, right?
Oh, absolutely. Because all of these, there's something about electromagnetism that affects your body different. When you listen to an MP3 and you listen to a vinyl or a cassette, it's something about the analog. It feels different, and people are realizing that. And, you know, I had to buy my daughter a turntable, and, you know, she gets records every week. She's 17, and she just turned 18, but she would call them vinyls. Dad, I want some vinyls. I was like, don't say that. Don't say vinyls. But, you know, here's this kid, and she came down to the studio and just raided my record collection. So, yeah, vinyl is back with the passion.
That's so cool. Back to the studio and some of the coolest people that have come through your door that have been most touching experiences for you.
Oh my God. Well, Al Green, obviously. Another life-changing experience was Solomon Burke. We did his last record. It was his last record and my dad's last record. Melissa Etheridge.
She was here not too long ago, right?
Yeah, Melissa was here last year. She did her record that's out now, Memphis Rock and Soul, and it was absolutely amazing. Melissa's guitar, she's got this guitar tone I've been trying to get all my life, and she came in and plugged her guitar up, and I was like, oh, that's it. That's what I've been trying.
Can we play a snippet of her?
Yeah, absolutely.
This album is out now, or?
Yes. It's called Memphis Rock and Soul, and it's all Stax covers. It's the songs that inspired her to do music.
And how did she find you? Why did she come here?
She knew she wanted to make the record in Memphis, and she courted, you know, some different studios. And I really think my aunt's pound cake is what sealed the deal.
With a smile on your face, you loved engineering that.
Oh my God, that record was so fun to make. John Burke, the president of Concord, produced the record, and I've always wanted to work with John. I knew him from seeing him at Grammy functions and stuff, and I was like, that dude is cool. You know, he's just like, he has one of those, you know, this energy that just like, he's a cool guy, you know, and he did that brilliant record, Ray Charles, Genius Loves Company. So I've always wanted to work with John. And, you know, when we got the call about Melissa and John, too, so it was like a double whammy for me. You know, one of my favorite singers and one of my favorite producers. So.
Together.
Together, yeah.
Now, maybe I'm wrong, but you're a Grammy Award winner, aren't you?
Yes. I won a Grammy for Uptown Funk.
There. So tell us that story. That must have been just so sweet for you.
It was. So I've been going to. I'm really active in the Memphis Grammy chapter. I've been a chapter president, and I'm still a board member. And so I go to the Grammys every year, and I vote. And so I remember waking up and looking at the online ballot and seeing my name, and I was like, so I called my the executive director, and I said, John, man, my name is on the Grammy website. I was like, does this mean I don't have to buy my tickets this year?
That's so cool.
He was like, yep, that's exactly what that means. It's like, cool.
I love it. Yeah. So that sweet moment for you.
Absolutely. Life-changing. And even to the event, people are like, are you going to go on stage? I was like, if I hear my name, yeah. And, everybody's like, you're going to win. And, I never like to count my chickens before they hatch. I knew the record was a really strong record. And when they announced it, it was like breathtaking. And then they started calling names. And as soon as I heard Boo Mitchell, I don't think I've ever ran that fast in my mind.
Was it kind of like a dream? You're kind of surreal?
It was completely surreal. Yeah. And, the record of the year, if you can believe it or not, there's never been a record made in Memphis to win that award. It's like it's the last award of the night. It's kind of like the pinnacle of all the Grammys. Memphis Records, I think Shaft was nominated for Record of the Year in 72, but there's no record that's, from Memphis ever actually won the award. So
nice.
It kind of felt, it's like I was doing it for my city.
Exactly. I mean? Yeah. That's what I was thinking as you're talking. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can we access it on your board? Yeah. Is it? Yeah. Absolutely love it. And the Grammy again was for?
Uptown Funk Record of the Year.
Nice. That's not bad.
Not too shabby at all.
I love it. Boo, I'm bummed, man. I got to say goodbye. I could keep you captive here for another hour, man.
Thank you, man. I appreciate you coming in. It's a big year for Royal Studios. It's our 60th year. So we're celebrating our 60th anniversary this year. We've been making music since 1957.
I love it. With 1960s technology.
Exactly.
So sweet.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you.
Once again, Boo Williams, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
All right. See you here.
I'm so in love with you.
My My name's John Doyle. I'm the executive director of both the Memphis Rock and Soul Museum and the Memphis Music Hall of Fame.
And we're right here in the downtown Memphis, right in the heart of old Memphis, right?
Yeah, we are a few feet from legendary Beale Street, and we're currently at the Memphis Music Hall of Fame, which is our newest museum. Rock and Soul, which was developed by the Smithsonian Institution, was opened in 2000. We opened the Memphis Music Hall of Fame to pay tribute to our legendary musicians in August of 2015. It was actually an expansion of our mission to preserve and tell the story of Memphis music and to perpetuate its legacy.
Did you intentionally want some separation and delineation between the two?
Yeah, it's great they're only a block away from each other, but we did want them to be separate because they have different feels and they have different purposes. The Rock and Soul Museum, since it was developed by the Smithsonian in an incredible way that Performing Songwriter magazine says it's perhaps the best exhibit of American music history in the country. And so as the Smithsonian would do it, it tells that history of Memphis music in an incredible way. The Memphis Music Hall of Fame pays tribute to the heroes of Memphis music, so it's a little more personal with the individuals. Rock and Soul Museum is located at FedEx Forum, which is our premier sports and entertainment complex. That's where the Rolling Stones perform. It's also where the Memphis Grizzlies NBA team performs. Memphis Music Hall of Fame is located adjacent to Hard Rock Cafe, one block to the west. It's at 2nd and Beale Street. Rock and Soul is at 3rd and Beale Street.
Here at the museum, it's focused more on people that performed and played specifically in Memphis.
Yeah, that's right. That's very fair to say. It is exactly what we wanted to do. We wanted, after people visit, and we sell them in combo, people can come to one museum or both, but after you've gone through Rock and Soul, you kind of understand the story.
The bigger picture?
That's exactly right. It's more about the civil rights of black musicians and white musicians coming together to create this sound that totally exploded, put Memphis on in the conscience of every country on the planet because of the musical explosion that happened here and the birth of rock and roll. But there are people behind that. Famous people like Elvis and Jerry Lee and B.B. King.
It seems like there's two levels. We know the stories of musicians who came to Mecca.
Yes,
who
that's
came
exactly
to
right.
Memphis because, like, they came to Nashville.
That's exactly right.
There also, I heard you talking earlier to somebody, there is some indigenous music and modalities that were started and birthed in the high school here. That's a cool story.
Yeah, absolutely. There are one of the people who was inducted the first year into the Memphis Music Hall of Fame was Professor W.T. McDaniel, who was the first African-American music teacher in our African-American schools when we had Caucasian white schools and African-American schools. And so for the first time, black students were able to be taught music.
They didn't have a music teacher or music program.
Yeah,
Only the white schools did.
As was, you know, the football uniforms were passed down. White schools were taken care of as far as textbooks, special programming like music and art and that sort of thing that wasn't available in the black schools. By Professor McDaniel, who had to share his time between two traditional black high schools, Manassas High School and Booker T. Washington High School, he became a professor for famous musicians like Phineas Newborn, Rufus Thomas, a little later Isaac Hayes. And so when you think about the music that came out of Memphis, Tennessee, and the sounds that came out of Stax and High and Duke Records,
that came out of that high school.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
That's cool.
Yeah, Booker T. Washington, which is a few blocks away from the Memphis Music Hall of Fame, one of the top high schools in Memphis today, still very predominantly African-American high school. But when you think about the musicians alone that came out of that high school, it's mind-blowing. And so that's kind of the cool thing. When we started working on the Memphis Music Hall of Fame, and we knew the expected names that everybody in the world knows, but when you start learning the length of it, I mean, you know, everybody knows Timberlake. Do you know that Timberlake was Memphis? Everybody knows, you know, Johnny Cash. They know B.B. King. But the tie-ins of Memphis, Tennessee with all of these musicians. And when we first started on our research about how many inductees should we expect and how long is it going to, you know, will we be through in 10 years or something like that? I've got in file in my office 350 names that hadn't gone in yet. And
how many do you induct each year?
We do about 6 or 7 each year, you know. And so we started with larger classes when we first started our first couple of years, and now we're at 6 or 7 per year. And I've promised the audiences that come to our induction ceremony each fall. We will, for the next 10, 15 years, every year we will be inducting a chart topper, a Grammy winner, a gold record performer, because that's really, you know, what comes out of Memphis. And it surprised me, many of the folks that, you know, I didn't know about. Maurice White from Earth, Wind, and Fire. You know, obviously the staple singers that came out of Memphis, Tennessee. ZZ Top, who we think of as that little band from Texas,
right,
who maintained a residence in Memphis for 13 years and recorded some of their biggest albums and biggest hits here.
Do you try and focus on the living over the dead?
No, not necessarily.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's one of the most rewarding things and one of the most challenging things, because people are passionate about music. And so each year when we induct people, I get a series of phone calls. Many of them are very heated. I've been cursed by people who can't believe that that ZZ Top was inducted before Johnny Cash, which I understand, that the Memphis Horns haven't been inducted yet. It's not a popularity contest.
What's the criterion? Who determines and how?
They have to have, we have a national nominating committee. One thing we decided was we wanted it to be done with integrity. And so we have people from one of the greatest drummers performing today, Steve Jordan, who's on the nominating committee, Randy Jackson, who is one of the American Idol judges, who understands Memphis music extremely well. Both Peter Gronick and Robert Gordon, both prominent authors of music and of Memphis music. As a matter of fact, Peter Gronick recently released the bio of Sam Phillips that has been purchased for movie rights. Then there, Leonardo DiCaprio will be starring in the movie based on Peter Gronick's book. And so we've got people who really know Memphis music and who weigh in on that. I don't choose anyone. No one with the museum chooses anyone.
They independently judge the material sent out to them.
That's exactly right. So criteria-wise, we talked first year, what should those criteria be? Should they have to have been born in Memphis? We hope not, because Elvis wasn't born in Memphis. Jerry Lee, Johnny Cash, B.B. King, you know, none of these folks were born in Memphis. They came to Memphis. You know, that's what Memphis was. Memphis was Mecca, where you came to record music, where this explosion was happening.
And like Nashville today is as much a powerhouse or more so than it ever was.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about Memphis and how its evolution has progressed today.
Yeah, if you want to make in country music, and you hear it constantly on TV shows like The Voice, etc., I wanted to make it in country music, so I moved to Nashville, you know, which is an industry with skyscrapers and record companies and things like that. Memphis is the birthplace of rock and roll and soul music, the home of the blues. We have maintained an authenticity that musicians come back here to resubmerge themselves in this magical thing that happened here in Memphis, that was a combination of where we were located, that we were a diverse city, that we were surrounded by agriculture, that we sat on the Mississippi River, all these things that played into us being what we are.
And it still remains.
It still reeks with every bit of that. I mean, our studios today, which are first-class, world-class studios, are celebrating this huge honeymoon period, because these A-list artists, who were originally the Keith Richards and the Rod Stewarts who wanted to come to Memphis to record, and now they are the Bruno Mars.
Let's go back in time. Yeah. Keith Richards, at that point in time, what would be the magnetism for him?
When these people in Great Britain, they were introduced to rock and roll music that exploded out of Memphis, they totally worshipped Elvis Presley and all things American. And to them, all things American were all things coming out of Memphis, Tennessee at the time. You know, the Pop Tunes record store would put out a playlist of songs that were selling the best, and the rest of the world looked at that playlist to see, long before we had internet or anything like that, what records are selling at Pop Tunes in Memphis, because that's the next hit maker. And so it totally influenced the British invasion. And, you know, you look at a lot of the band members from Led Zeppelin, from Rolling Stones, who came and who purchased grave markers for blues musicians whose family couldn't afford grave markers, who totally influenced their careers. And so someone like Keith Richards, who came and recorded at legendary Royal Studios, where Al Green recorded, he wanted to go there because he wanted to record into the microphone that Al Green recorded into. Wow. And it is more a part of reconnecting. And, you know, Nashville can connect you to a music industry. Memphis can connect you to a musical soul.
The parallel would be Studio B in Nashville.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And so we're seeing a lot of it. Like I mentioned, Bruno Mars recorded here year before last. Melissa Etheridge, her latest album, Memphis Rock and Soul, was recorded at Royal Studios as well. Sun Studios, which is a huge tourist attraction, but still a recording studio. Obviously, early on with Rattle and Hum, U2 recorded there. John Mayer has recorded at Royal Studios. They just got finished recording Robert Cray for the second or third time at that studios. And so these folks come here. Jack White has recorded at Electrophonic Studios. Ardent Studios continues to record practically everybody. The list of people who have recorded at Ardent Studios, which they don't promote heavily, but, you know, pretty much anyone in music has recorded at Ardent Studios here in Memphis. And it's about, if you're a musician and you've gone this far in your career, how do you reconnect so that your next 10 years are as powerful as your last 10 years? Memphis can do that for a musician.
That's really fascinating. If you have a couple minutes, I know it's getting late and people are closing up. Let's take a real high-speed walking tour. And as we go, let's start with the legacy and history of this physical building.
History. Sure. The history of it is fascinating because this was, when you're talking about early Memphis, this was Burke's carriage repairs. And so actually carriages were done in this very building and horses were hoofed and everything like that. But then later than that, store called Lansky Brothers Clothiers, and they were operating on Beale Street in this exact building when Elvis Presley was a young teenager. And so these young musicians who started coming here and buying their clothes here, Hal Lansky, who's now the owner of Lansky's clothing store, his father Bernard Lansky operated it during the heyday of Elvis, tells the great story of Johnny Cash coming into this exact building with a can of Prince Albert tobacco and saying, "Mr. Lansky, I want a coat just like this," the long black coat that Prince Albert wore on the front of that tobacco can. So he brought him up to the second floor where the exhibit is, where we're standing right now, and that's where Johnny Cash bought his very first black coat to become the Man in Black and purchased black from then on from Mr. Lansky and then obviously elsewhere. So the building itself is rich as far as Memphis history. It's rich as far as music history. As far as the exhibit itself, what we look for, because Rock and Soul, which was put together by the Smithsonian, looks very Smithsonian. It's about a story. We wanted this building to be, since it wasn't about a museum story like Rock and Soul was, it is about you connecting with this artist that you really love. Ever since we inducted Justin Timberlake, people have been calling saying, "When is the Justin Timberlake memorabilia going to be installed?" Which is happening 2 weeks from now.
I feel really bad about this. We're getting the 5 minute sign.
That's okay.
So let's really quick, and I'll have to come back because this I could spend a day here easy.
Absolutely.
Give us a highlight of some of the coolest stuff.
We wanted this to be cool belongings to people. Obviously, you have B.B. King's guitar. You've got Isaac Tay's organ. Standing here, you've got clothes from both Isaac Hayes and David Porter, who worked together to do some of the greatest soul songs of all time. A Furry Lewis guitar is almost impossible to find. Most of the blues musicians, they didn't keep their stuff. A lot of times they had to sell it or the family had to sell it in order to bury them. There was a gentleman in North Dakota who owned Furry Lewis's guitar, and we found out about him through Acoustic Guitar Magazine, and we contacted him, asked him if he'd put it in loan at the Memphis Music Hall of Fame, and he said, "You probably want the case as much as you want the guitar," because, of course, Furry had his name there.
This thing looks amazing.
Like a dinosaur. It's hard to tell on radio, but there is a grand piano that is completely decomposed that is in a pristine white display case. Jim Dickinson, folks have to go online and look up Jim Dickinson, who was one of the greatest producers to come out of Memphis, worked with the Rolling Stones, Ry Cooder, and so many other musicians. And he had a studio in Coldwater, Mississippi, Zebra Ranch. And his sons are now North Mississippi All-Stars, people who know more current music. This was the last piano that came out of Stax Records. It was a white grand piano that Isaac Hayes wrote many of the songs that were recorded at Stax Records. And when Stax closed, Jim Dickinson purchased this piano. He was an eccentric type, and he was an artist. Aside from being a musician, he was an artist, and he loved to create pieces of art and put them outside. He believed in the earth taking things back, and things, the progress of decomposition was part of the whole progress of life and everything.
Well, he got halfway done with that project.
That's exactly right. And so he put this grand piano in front of his studio in Coldwater, Mississippi. And so this grand piano, which stood in front of his studios, the likes of Robert Plant and Robert Palmer even, and Bob Dylan laid their hands on this as they were going into his studio. And it was decomposing and falling apart. And so his belief was that it was being completely reclaimed and becoming a work of art. So we wanted to display it like a work of art.
Okay, two more are really cool.
We have half of Jerry Lee Lewis's Cadillac. We've got the left half of Jerry Lee Lewis's Cadillac.
Does he still have the right half?
He does have the right
half.
In his living room?
No.
At Jerry Lee Lewis Cafe and Honky Tonk, which is on Beale Street. The other half of the car is at his restaurant, which is two blocks further down on Beale Street. Elvis's mobile phone, before any of us had mobile phones, were here. Again, we're getting ready to install the coat and tie and bandstand from JT and the Tennessee Kids from Justin Timberlake's 2020 tour. Things from Big Star, Rufus Thomas, the Oscar trophy from 3-6 Mafia that they won for best original score. You know, it's all here, including tons of touch screens where people can test their Memphis music knowledge. Tons of screens where they can see interviews from any of these folks.
And I bet you have a lot of archival stuff that's not on display.
Yeah, plenty of stuff. And the great thing about the Memphis Music Hall of Fame, it evolves every year because we induct new people, and with that comes new stories, new memorabilia.
Sadly and regretfully, gotta say sayonara.
Memphis will always be here, so even though you have to sign off now, folks can come here to this great city, and we will always be here. Anyone's welcome here anytime. My name again is John Doyle, director of Memphis Music Hall of Fame. You can find us online, memphismusichalloffame.com, and contact us anytime and come see us.
John, what a pleasure. Thank you. It was great to meet you and great to come here even though it was almost midnight.
Thanks for giving us a break. Appreciate it.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Memphis, Tennessee.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com. Our associate producers include Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Kim Schneider from Michigan, Elaine Masters in San Diego, Julie Henning, Eugene, Oregon, and Steve Cook, contributing from Little Rock, Arkansas, host of Arkansongs on NPR affiliate KUAR.